Welcome back to Reflections. At the end of the last segment, we were discussing, reflecting on 60 Minutes and the firing of Scott Pelley and a few of other staff members of 60 Minutes and the resignation of Anderson Cooper. And in this podcast, you see a person under great stress, and it was only about 3 or 4 days after, I think, that tumultuous firing. He wasn't expecting it. I went into the meeting, I thought, discussing what would be happening and going forward, an explanation, what the new strategies were, and it was clear he was going to be fired. It's clear how this hit him so strongly. As he was trying to explain his feelings, could see him breathing, taking deep. A number of times he was tears in his eyes, and yet you could see that he was accepting what had happened. And so you could see he was on his way to handling it the way it has to be handled. Those were the cards that he was handed, and he had to just go forward with it. And one of the decisions in terms of the cards was to go forward in a podcast like this that's going to be watched by many, 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 many people. And you out there probably can get this on YouTube and through the internet, listen to to that particular podcast. It's powerful. It's powerful. One of the things that kind of surprised me is despite how strongly he feels that the way it's going, and the fact that at the end he says that 60 Minutes and CBS is on fire, news is on fire. So it's pretty dramatic as how worried he is about it. But as he goes forward, he's relatively kind and generous with the people who have fired him and all. He basically is saying that doesn't have anything against them personally. He just doesn't think they're prepared, that they have the experience in order to move and make the right decisions. It's a pretty good way of pointing to the situation, and yet keeping the value of being kind and being relatively respectful within this moment. And on the other hand, he's resolute. I mean, he's clear what his values are and what he understands needs to be, going forward and with 60 Minutes. And one of the things he's very strong about, that 60 Minutes has moved with the time, with the internet and with all the social media, and he explains how prevalent it is in the social medias, and how digitally the 60 Minutes is so watched, and how great it had 9% increase in viewers last year, and in the program per se, and then of course in the internet and all. So he's pretty proud and resolute about it. Yet he's kind of I found it to be a good balance. And we always talk about the critical need to have balance, and as we go forward. The other thing that comes across throughout is he's more concerned about the program and the people that are there than he is about himself. And in fact, he's clear that given the concerns he has, he still would have remained with the program in order to keep it going as well as possible and going through. Sometimes these changes don't develop as you feared or expected, and you can make impact so that the changes don't develop as you may have feared. So he's pretty clear with respect to that, and it's a good you know, a balance of concern, yet not taking all that personally in terms of what's really important, which is the program itself. And in terms of personal, you know, attacks, there was a moment towards the end where the interviewer, you know, tells him, and he hadn't heard it before, you know, Trump's advice or feelings about him, his opinions about him, and I'm quoting now. He says, "I think Scott Pelley's got his own problems. He's terrible," Trump told Miranda Devine in her Pod Force One podcast. "Look, Scott Pelley's a stiff, and he's afraid, and he's part of this, you know, gang of crooked, stupid people that don't care about our country." And Scott Pelley's reaction to that was kind of interesting. He says, you know, he said, "Stupid, well, you know, okay, I can handle that." He said, "Stiff, yeah, probably." Probably that's the thing. But where he really said, "Listen, when it comes to not caring about my country," he says, and after pause, it says, "I've never worn a uniform, but I've been in combat for this country in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Kuwait." He continued, "I've been shot at, spent nights in foxholes filling up with water in the desert. I'm not aware that the President of the United States has ever done any of those things for this country. Please correct me if I'm right." Then he says, holding in this article, holding back tears as he went on, "You become a journalist because you love the First Amendment," he said. "You become a journalist because you love the country. And while all of those other descriptions that the president used about me might be applicable, not that one." Very strong, very powerful, you know, kind of ending towards the thing. So a deep breath. I hope 60 Minutes survives. It continues as good or even better than it has been. But it doesn't look good. In the meantime, and it started with the an interview of Díaz-Canel, the president of Cuba, about a month and a half ago. I had seen the program Meet the Press every once in a while, but that one I really wanted to see that interview. Incidentally, in 60 Minutes, an excellent interview was on Netanyahu, and you know, that's the kind of segment that really stands out. Netanyahu made it very clear that he's a hawk, and that he believes you know, Iran has to be, yeah, frankly, destroyed, and you know, he's moving on that line, and he has, you know, a lot of pressures for that position. So it's making life pretty difficult for President Trump, who probably doesn't want that much of a hawkish action and statements from his partner Netanyahu. But anyway, going back to Meet the Press, I went because of the, you know, Díaz-Canel. It was an excellent interview, and then so I've been, of course, recording it and watching it whenever I finally have the chance. That's on Sunday mornings, and the last one was an interview of Trump. It was kind of difficult because they were in a steel building and rain, you know, didn't allow the transmission to be as clear as they would want. In fact, at a given moment, they had to stop. But it was an excellent interview by Kristen Welker, is her name. And I've come to admire her very much. And it ended up with Trump getting very upset because she said that he said that the elections in California and the elections that he had back in the past were stolen. And she said, you know, what's the proof? And kind of insisted, and he got upset and criticized her. My darling, I hope you have a good day. And stepped away in a huff. And that was an interesting. Let's go in, because then it was Iran, and a lot of it was respect to Iran, and not so much Ukraine. She didn't ask much about Ukraine, but about Iran. And there's been some excellent articles in Foreign Affairs. It's one of my favorite magazines, and one of them kind of goes along with what I've been kind of saying is. The title is Iran as Vietnam, Ukraine as Korea. Similar wars end in similar ways by Gideon Rose. This is May 20th, 2026. He's saying that, though much quicker, he says what Trump has done in 2 months, and, you know, it was about 5 years of the Johnson administration with entry, escalation, frustrated stalemate and negotiation, and says now it's on the Nixon administration turf, blustery threats, gradual realization of need to extricate via the unsatisfying deal. And if this pace holds, the intervention in Iran should be over in another few months, at which point the recriminations will have begun. And so, it's along with what happened in Vietnam, and I've used that analogy in my past programs on reflections. And then with respect to Ukraine, he compares it to Korea, and again, it's what I've been saying. At the end of the day, there's going to be a line. Where that line's going to be, whether it's now. You know, initially, of course, Trump wanted all of Ukraine, but at this moment, he wants the whole Donbass area, which he doesn't control the whole. But basically, you know, about 20%. And it's going to be, at the end, there's going to be a line, and there's going to be, like in Korea, safeguards that people live by that particular line. And we're going to kind of, that's going to be a similar solution. That's what this article is saying. So I'm so much in line with it. Of course, every case is different. I mean, he makes it clear there are differences. They're not exactly the same situation. I love the ending. He says, perhaps the most striking aspect of all this historical rhyming is a repeated, naive, across-the-board wish-casting of wartime leaders who casually assume that the military force can easily bring political gains, that the enemy won't respond, and that serious strategic planning is unnecessary. In war, as in the market, the most dangerous words might be, quote, this time is different. Okay, we'll see. We'll see whether this time is different, or history has shown us that what are probably going to be the final resorts. And there were two other articles. One is June 1, 2026 by Jack Watlington. Ukraine turns the tide, and why a ceasefire is now a real possibility. Goes in line with the other article. And basically, you know, that Russia's having trouble replenishing its troops. Ukraine is being able to do so with the drones at the short range and long range. They're slowly recovering territory, and it's, you know, relatively a stalemate, which is not what, you know, Putin expected and wanted, and so. The tide is turning for Ukraine, and we've been talking about that last few weeks. And then another article, Iran's new grand strategy, how a remade Islamic Republic will reshape the Middle East. This is by two writers. Let me see what their standing is. They're a professor of international affairs and Middle East studies at the Johns Hopkins University. One of them, both of them are with Johns Hopkins. The basic argument is that the position is that we have a new leadership at the Islamic Revolutionary Guard at the Ayatollah, the new son who's taking over, and Parliament, and that they're all it's a new generation that's not so tied to this religious fanaticism. It's more pragmatic, and that change in terms of their outlooks, but that they're much more pragmatic, much more nationalistic, and less religious fervor that loses the practical aspects of moving forward. And with that kind of a change, it's going to be a difference. It says, the turn away from dogma and towards pragmatic statecraft does not make the Islamic Republic more benign. National security states are often brutal to their own people and destabilizing the international order. The emergent Islamic Republic will remain highly authoritarian, but the categories that Western analysts have often used to describe as various factions, hardliners versus moderates, ideologues versus reformists, will be less accurate than ever. The priorities of the new Islamic Republic and how it pursues them will be shaped by the specific experiences of its two wars with Israel and the United States. The losses Iran sustains, the confidence its leadership gained, and the new social contract the fighting has made necessary and possible. So, it's in the works, but there's a substantial change in the way the leadership looks at its handling of politics and the war. Enough of Ukraine and all. When we get back, I'm going to be discussing a little bit more cultural aspects that took place this weekend, with a little bit of a religious tenet as to what weekend should be like. And then maybe that towards the end, I want to get into again some brain health and some people and what's really critical for our well-being in terms of taking care of ourselves with some examples. Okay, we'll be right back after the pause. This is your host, Jorge Gonzalez, Reflections.